My name's, it's not nice actually. It tastes like chewing gum that's lost most of its flavour.
What does your surname taste of?
It's difficult to describe. It's a bit like sucking on wool trousers. My family have all got their own specific flavours and textures. My mother, for example, who is called Doreen, she has the, I call it a taste, but it's more of an experience. It's like the brain freeze you get when you drink very, very cold water or ice cream. And my father, whose name is Peter, he tastes like processed peas. My sister's blackcurrant yogurt. And my grandmother was very creamy, thick, condensed milk.
Welcome to The Compass on the BBC World Service, and the final episode in our series on the senses. So far, we've looked at individual senses: touch, vision, hearing, and together smell and taste, focusing on glitches in our sensory system and how that changes our perception of the world. In this programme, we explore synesthesia, a mixing of two or more senses that aren't usually connected. One triggers the other due to differences, not defects, in the brain's wiring. Some synesthetes, for example, can hear a colour or taste a sound. And we'll consider how each of us experiences our own unique reality, constructed by our brain, and question what is real and what is an illusion. I'm Guy Leschtener, a neurologist working in the National Health Service in London.
When I heard that I'll be speaking to you, Guy, the word Guy produces a word sound.
This might be worrying. What does Guy taste like?
Well, it produces a word sound that gives me a taste and texture, something similar to fudge, which is rather nice.
That's very kind of you.
Yeah, because some of these are bad. Somebody asked me what their name tasted like at a function. I'm ashamed to say it's like lumpy vomit. Her name's Maureen. It's awful.
This is James Wonerton. He has a rare type of synesthesia where he experiences tastes and textures for every sound he hears. It's most predominant with word sounds, and it's involuntary.
Whenever I hear a word, whenever I read a word, because when you read, you tend to hear the word in your mind's eye, if you like, inner speech, I call it.
My name's Julia Simner. I am a professor of neuropsychology at University of Sussex. Synesthesia is a rare psychological trait that causes differences in thinking and in sensory perception. It's often described as a merging of the senses because it can cause one sense to become blurred or merged with another.
Roughly 4% of the population has synesthesia, but in many people it may be so subtle as to go unrecognised. For James, however, it has always been much more obvious.
I first remember experiencing tastes and textures specifically when I was going to school, aged, what, 4 and a half? My mother used to take me to school on the tube, and I was learning to read and write at the time, so I used to read out the names of the stations as we passed through and off the maps. And I used to get tastes and textures. My favourite tube station was Tottenham Court Road, because there's so many lovely words in there. Tottenham produced the taste and texture of a sausage. Court was like a lovely, crispy fried egg. And road was toast. So there you've got a pre-made breakfast.
Full English fry-up.
Yeah. Feels like I'm really eating. It's a mouthfeel. And I'm getting them now constantly. As each of these sounds come in, I get a drip of taste. And if it's a particularly strong synesthetic taste and flavour, then it will take ages to fade.
You'd be forgiven for thinking that James's descriptions are rather far-fetched. Indeed, as a child, his doctor dismisses them as simply a boy's wild imagination. Yet, thanks to the advances of science, we now have evidence that synesthesia is a very real condition. For starters, it's thought that there is a genetic link.
In the last 10 years, we've been able to start to detect individual genes that appear to be implicated in developing synesthesia. Now, interestingly, those genes tend to have a role in synaptic guidance, and that means they tend to determine how the brain becomes wired up.
Unsurprisingly, there are also variations in brain circuitry between synesthetes and non-synesthetes.
Since 1995, we've been able to see those differences using brain scanning. One important study in 2005 showed that synesthetes' sensory cortices, that's the parts of their brain that do the seeing and tasting and hearing and so on, are more active than the average person. So colour regions of their brain will light up when they read letters, or taste regions might light up when they hear words.
James is part of these early scans.
They certainly showed that James's taste regions were different to the control group. In his insula, which is a taste-selected region of the brain, we found that it was activating much more than the average person simply when he read words.
The actual synesthetic tastes, this produces a lot of physical side effects. I get stomach acid pumped into my stomach for food that isn't there.
Think about it. James's synesthesia is extraordinary. There's no food entering his mouth or smells through his nose, creating taste, texture and flavour. Instead, it's his auditory system triggering these sensations and causing him a physical reaction that feels very real.
My name is Valeria Perboni, and today we're here in the Limbury foyer of the Royal Opera House in London.
Valeria is 23. She's a musician and performer, currently doing a master's in music psychology. She's also a synesthete, although she didn't realise until her teens.
When I was 13, 14 years old, at school, we student had to prepare a little film to present this book to the rest of the students. And I was asked to do the music. And I remember talking to my dad about this, and it was like, I could do it in D major, because, you know, the cover of the book is green, so it would make sense. And he could not understand what I was talking about.
When Valeria hears music, she sees colours. And each musical key is a different shade. She sees green when she hears D major. So for her, it makes complete sense to set her musical composition in that key, to reflect the green of the book cover. But she discovers not everyone shares this experience.
I was like, we don't usually see colours when we hear music. I was like, oh, okay.
And at that time, had you experienced that previously? Were you aware of that association between colours and sound?
I was. It's always been there. And when I realised that it wasn't normal, I sort of started, you know, keeping it to myself.
So as Valeria plays her teenage composition, she sees colours, but she also feels textures or sensations as she hears the music.
So when I start with this, that was the colour green.
Yeah.
And it's very green and fresh, and it almost feels like if you cut a lime in two and you touch the inside of it, it's fresh, and that sensation, it's what I feel when I play this.
And do you see the colour green, or is it in your mind's eye?
It's here. It's
in your periphery.
In my peripheral vision. So it's like as if I had a light just behind my head, projecting this way. If I try and look at it, it's difficult because it moves with me.
So it's a tinge of green in your periphery. And when you change key in that piece, then that colour changes as well.
Absolutely. So when this happens, it's sort of like the blending of the two colours. It's like as if the green was wiped away with a brush of blue, and now it becomes blue. And this fifth, It's like a dot of yellow in the blue.
And when the colour changes, do the textures that you feel change as
yes,
well?
Yes, yeah, they all have very specific textures. So, for example, if this is very fresh and quite light and silky, almost, this feels much more, much warmer. And that's a funny thing, because blue is a cold colour,
yeah.
But blue feels warm to me.
When you say you feel it, is that, do you feel it on your skin?
Yes.
You feel it on your skin?
Yes. Most of the time when I feel something is kind of like hugging me, so the upper back and sort of like the shoulders and the arms, that's usually a good sensation. Whereas like if I'm playing this, that's like, these chords are quite sharp and the colour, it's a yellow but quite a stabbing yellow, and I feel it right here in my back, and this is like, and they're not like, they're not exactly dissonant, but it feels slightly more uncomfortable.
For Valeria, her synesthesia is almost all embracing, merging hearing, vision and sensation. She's not imagining, but actually seeing the colours of the music projected outside her body, in her peripheral vision, and feeling the sensations against her skin, at times both exquisite and painful. And it's consistent. D major, for example, is always green. A major is always purple, with the texture of mousse. And that consistency, like James's word tastes being the same now as when he was a small boy, is further evidence that this is a very real phenomenon.
We know that their brains act differently because they are built differently, very subtly differently. Synesthetes have extra connections in the white matter of the brain, and they also have thicker grey matter. Now, white matter is like the brain's wiring, and grey matter is the bodies of the brain cells.
Synesthesia clearly illustrates that the way we perceive the world around us is the outcome of our brain function and structure, at times as a result of damage or disease, as we've seen in previous programmes, but also as a result of normal human variation. And this divergence of the human experience is not just limited to our external sensations. It can also affect our internal world.
My name is Sherry Bakes, and I'm a painter, and I'm living and working on Vancouver Island in Canada. I was confused. I didn't understand what had happened. I didn't know if I'd ever walk again. Like, I just didn't know what my life was going to be like.
When Sherry is 29, she has a stroke, leaving her unable to walk, unable to read. She slowly recovers, but finds that she's no longer able to picture images in her mind.
Say, if in your mind there's a screen, as soon as I would try and project anything on that screen, it would dissolve. It was like there was something wrong with the light bulb in the projector in my mind.
She tries to explain it to her family, but no one understands.
I went to my eye doctor a handful of times saying, I can't see properly. And, you know, he'd test my vision and it was fine. I knew something was wrong, but I just didn't understand until I heard Adam talk about it on the radio.
My name is Adam Zeman. I'm Professor of Cognitive and Behavioural Neurology at the University of Exeter in the southwest of England. The mind's eye is the capacity that most of us have to summon up an image of something in its absence. So if I ask you to visualise your front door or an apple or a friend, you can probably bring into consciousness an image which has a kind of visual feel. It's not going to be necessarily very detailed or very vivid, but it'll be a little bit as if you were seeing.
In 2003, Adam meets a patient who's lost his ability to form mental images. At the time, there's no clear name for this condition, so Adam calls it aphantasia, meaning without a mind's eye. Some 12 years later, he's on the radio describing it. For Sherry, It's a revelation.
It's like I had prickles go through my entire body and my jaw dropped and I had to pull over. Like I was literally shaking because I could not believe what I was hearing. And I thought, this is what's going on. This is what I can't do anymore. It was so profound.
She immediately contacts Adam.
He really helped me just understand what it was that I was living with now. And for me, going from having such a strong and vivid visual imagination to going completely internally blind was, to me, that was the most traumatic experience of having a stroke.
In fact, this inability to conjure up mental imagery is quite common. Aphantasia affects about 2% of the population, and like synesthesia, it's considered on the spectrum of normal brain function. But unlike the vast majority who have never been able to visualise, Sherry is acutely aware of what she's lost, particularly having relied on it so heavily as an artist.
For me, it feels like a disability. I mean, it was who I was. I couldn't imagine anything. And my imagination was where I lived.
Aphantasia reminds us how important what is happening in our heads is to us. The idea that perception is much more inside out than we used to think.
It sounds, talking to you, Sherry, that you're still very much grieving for your mind's eye.
Yeah, I have a little bit of trouble hiding that, don't I?
Mm.
Yeah, I loved that part of life.
As we've seen throughout this series, disorders of our nervous system can change the relationship between reality and what we perceive it to be. But what aphantasia and synesthesia show us is that many of us experience a slightly different version of the world outside us, and indeed our own internal world. And if that's the case, that all of us are seeing something slightly differently, then which one of us is really perceiving reality?
So James, now obviously your reality is rather different to other people's reality. What does that make you think about how reliable our senses actually are?
Well, I've always viewed that as being something rather positive because, it's neurodiversity. Everybody sees things in a different way. I meet lots of synesthetes. We've had 10 people look at one object and we've taken 6 or 7 vastly different perceptions of that one object. You know, some people pick up on the shapes because of the colour of it or the flavour of it. It'll produce a sound that they like or don't like and they won't like it because of that.
So which one of those is experiencing reality?
Well, they're all experiencing different forms of reality.
Except, what actually is reality? Do our senses even show us the truth about reality? Or is it all just an illusion? In normal life, we at least experience a rough approximation of reality. A red apple on a table in front of us may be seen as a different colour by someone who's colourblind, or may taste of ice cream to a synesthete. But there is indeed an apple on that table. If that wasn't the case, surely evolution would have wiped us out. But not all scientists even agree on this. The cognitive neuroscientist, Professor Donald Hoffman from the University of California, Irvine, has another theory. We don't see the world as it really is, because
seeing the truth will make you extinct.
In other words, too much information is a killer. Simplify it and survive is the short way of interpreting his hypothesis, based on evolutionary gaming theory and quantum physics, which says,
you don't need to know about the structure of the world, you just need to know simple symbols about what to do. Do this and don't do that to stay alive. It's much like if you're working on your computer and you have a desktop interface. Now, in this metaphor, inside the computer, it's really complicated. There's circuits and software and voltages and magnetic fields, but that's not what we see. We see, simple little icons, blue rectangular icons for files and so forth. that interface allows us to control all the complicated circuits and software, even though we're ignorant about those circuits and software. And that's what evolution has done for us. Our perceptions of space and time and physical objects is not a picture of reality. It's a user interface that's there explicitly to hide reality.
For Hoffman, the universe is too complex for us truly to perceive through our senses. The limitations of our brains have led us to create shortcuts, creating a world that allows us to survive, but is in no way reflective of reality. Hoffman's theory is extreme and far from universally accepted. But whatever the truth about the nature of reality, everyone's perception of the world is different. We're a product of our genes, our lived experiences, and our personality, all of which affect how we interpret our surroundings. But how our brain is structured has a huge influence on how we perceive the world around us. For Valeria, her synesthesia adds another dimension.
There is one sensation that is just utter beauty. When I've been listening to very specific pieces of music where my thumb just is so painful, but that pain is the most beautiful thing, and it means that music is just so full of colours and textures. And actually, Ravel Piano Concerto is one of them. There is one moment when the oboe comes in. That's just perfection.
I'm struck by the fact that you experience the world in a much more rich and multimodal way than most of us. Is that something that you just take for granted, or is it something that you're appreciative of?
I am appreciative of this. It's something quite special to be able to see colours when you hear music. Do I take it for granted? Sometimes, yes, I do, because it's always been there.
I'm Guy Leschziner, and this BBC World Service programme was produced by Sally Abrahams. If you've missed any of the previous episodes in this series, you can find them on the BBC website.